Hey everyone, you're listening to the Working Triathlete Podcast. This podcast is devoted to helping you find maximum performance with deliberate efficiency. Hey everyone, this is Derek.
And this is Conrad.
And you're listening to the Working Triathlete Podcast. Today, you know, we're going to break down the Ironman Texas results. We're going to talk about a marathon I competed in this past weekend and break down a little bit of the nutrition pre-marathon, race nutrition during the marathon and kind of what that build looked like as well, and then how the race unfolded.
Yes, I'm excited to talk about all of those things. And so I guess we can start with Ironman Texas. Ironman Texas, it was the first Ironman of the Ironman Pro series, and it was a very interesting race to watch. I think, you know, we can start with the women. Kat Matthews won. She threw down a balanced performance, 55 minute swim, 4:41 bike, 3 hour run. And Penny Slater was second. And it was a pretty tight race, I think, up front. The top three women were just within a few minutes. You know, sometimes there's an abyss between the top three, but this was, you know, it appeared to be, you know, a pretty solid race. Lottie Wilms was third at 8:46. So they navigated an interesting day at Texas. It was very windy. It was very, very hot. And I know that, you know, I read on Slow Twitch that maybe there was some interference with the top male age groupers kind of interfering with the women's pro race a little bit, as one often would expect when there are thousands of athletes competing. But we'll see how that influences things. But I heard that a few women actually crashed, and which is not great. I do wonder to what extent the wind played a role. I know that there were gusts. I mean, peak gusts for the day were 30 some miles an hour, and it's tough riding in that, especially if you're light. But you know, so good race there. Good to see Kat Matthews take the W. But I think the story of the day was on the men's side. Sort of had a, I don't know if you can call him a dark horse, because, you know, he's won a couple of 70.3s already as a pro, but, you know, he's newer. And Tomas Rodriguez Hernandez became the first Mexican to win an Ironman. And it was a pretty incredible performance. He went 7:42, so he beat Patrick Lang, who went 7:44, and Clement Mignon was third. Matthew Marquardt was fourth. Matt Hansen, I think I read that Matt Hansen grabbed a Kona qualifying spot. He was seventh. So, you know, and it was a fast day at Texas for sure. But just to break down Tomas's performance, I know that people like to hear about the numbers. And so he swam 49 minutes. That's 1:11 per 100. That was according to his Strava. He biked a 4:14, and his power was 245 watts. So that's obviously not that high for, you know, it's not as high as one might expect when we hear, you know, Sam Laidlow putting out over 310 watts at Kona and other Ironman athletes kind of putting out that kind of power. But obviously Tomas has worked on being aerodynamic, and he's substantially lighter than a lot of other pro triathletes. You know, I think he's in the 130, 135-ish pound range based on what I could find online. So he doesn't need to put out as much raw power. And then he ran a 2:34, which is 5:54 pace. So in that kind of heat, that's pretty impressive. I know it got up deep into the 80s, and he certainly won the race on the run. as we often see at Texas. That's seems like runners do well there. I think part of it is because they tend to be a little bit smaller, so they're better at, dissipating heat, which is relevant as we just had an entire podcast on that concept. But, 234 is flying.
It's fast. Oh. It's very fast. And I mean, I know he set the Texas course record for the run. And I think it was close to the Ironman run record. But yeah, pretty incredible performance from someone that, he's won races. We haven't heard a lot from him or about him, but now he's on the circuit. Like, people know who he is now. An incredible performance. He beat people, obviously, with a proven track record. So he's in it now.
Yeah, I know. I first heard about him. He did Oceanside last year, and he was 7th or 8th there with a very, very strong run. And I recall there was some discussion about kind of his bike position and setup and things like that. And, he dialed that in and obviously focused on reducing CDA and becoming efficient on the bike. And that's very important, especially at the Ironman distance where you're putting out power for a long time and lower CDA will pay off big time. But he kind of reminds me of Patrick Laying, just in the sense that, he's going to run everybody down. And it's going to, I think he's going to excel probably in the heat, it seems like. And so is he a contender at Kona? Obviously.
I think he's already proven it. Yeah. If he can do well in the heat, which, and he can run that well in the heat, like he did at 2:34, he's certainly a contender. And I think being lighter on the bike, I know Kona's not completely flat, but being able to climb, with his weight to power ratio will be important there as well. I think Texas is pretty flat, right, on the bike, so raw power matters a little bit more. But and his swims well, like he swims very fast as well, so he's well balanced, no weaknesses. It'll be really interesting to see how he performs as well. I think he's pretty young too. He's definitely, I believe, mid-20s.
Yeah, he is young. And when we think about the kind of, it seems like at Texas is a course where one would think an Uber cyclist could excel just because it's flat and watts to CDA matters more than watts to kilogram. But obviously he won it here at Texas. So if we think about throwing in some elevation, it's like, does it help to be, and it was very windy at Texas, but if you think about Kona, there's more elevation gain. There's more wind, almost certainly, even though it was a windy day at Texas. I mean, Kona is almost certainly going to be as windy. But he proved that he can win and ride pretty darn well in sort of windy conditions where, again, one would think that somebody who put out a lot more power would be able to outbike him substantially. But he threw down a great performance. I should say, so he biked 4:14. But if we look at, Matthew Marquardt, congrats to Matthew. So he got 4th overall. And he rode 4:03. Mm-hmm. So we do need to put it into a little bit of context. It's like, Tomas won, but then there are athletes who can ride 4:03, like other good athletes who can also run well. Obviously everybody wasn't the best in the world. Weren't there, but I mean, Patrick Lang is always a contender at Kona. I mean, many of these athletes are classified as best in the world. So I want to be careful when I say that, but we think about who's towing the line at Kona, what are the bike dynamics there? It's going to be a different beast, but it's just exciting. It's exciting to have somebody else who's going to be up there and potentially running the field down. It'd be kind of funny to watch Hernandez and Lang kind of work together and run next to each other and catch everybody. That would be entertaining to watch.
Yeah, I think you know, we got a little bit of foresight going on right now of what might happen, because I could certainly see that happening, because he biked about a 2 or a 4:16. So, I mean, they're pretty comparable across the board. You know, the
Yeah.
results at Texas are pretty even as well. So that's probably a pretty true statement right there.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting. But moving on to other things that happened this weekend, many working triathletes ran marathons. So, you know, we had a good showing at Nashville Rock and Roll. We had a couple really good athletes who ran well, broke 2 hours, 50 minutes, qualified for Boston. And so Tanner and Chris, they crushed it.
Yeah, great result. You know, Tanner, he's ran a sub 2:40 before, but he's getting back into the swing of things. Chris is his first marathon, and his execution on race day was perfect. And I mean, he nails every workout, and you know, it shows that consistency pays off. And I know it was warm down there too for that race. And I told all the athletes I coach that were racing, like, just be patient, because people are gonna melt. And that course is. It's a rolling course, but there's a lot of energy out there. Really keeps people motivated. But again, yeah, that's a course where being patient pays off.
It does. It was a pretty warm day and it was humid and I was everywhere. I was on the bike kind of riding to different points and trying to cheer everybody on. And I remember a couple athletes, working triathletes, coming up through 12 South. I mean, they were just soaking wet. They were drenched, and you could tell that it was warm. But you know, they did a good job cooling and they persevered and crushed it. You know, a couple athletes right around 3 hours, you know, three flat. And I know Nick, one athlete who went right around three flat, he twisted his ankle really badly and was thinking about dropping out. And he was kind of hobbling, and then he kind of got it together and then decided to finish, but slow down basically 2 minutes per mile. You know, it's not a traumatic, I mean, it was a pretty bad injury and it hurt. He'll recover in a couple of weeks, but he finished, and I was riding, and I found him, I was riding next to him, and he's like, I'm like, you know, how are you doing? And he's like, I'm finishing for my son, because his little boy was watching. So he finished to kind of show his son that you can kind of persevere and complete tasks and not so ideal scenarios. And I think that is kind of a good segue into your very strong performance this past weekend. You know, when we think about kind of overcoming a little bit of adversity and dark mental spaces in the middle of a race to kind of bring it home and finish the thing. So you won Glass City Marathon in Toledo, Ohio, which is a very competitive race. So they have an elite field there, and you ended up topping the field. So what was your time there?
Yeah, so I went 2:28:30, and I will, you know, I'll tell the story about how everything unfolded in a second here. But you know, time kind of went out the window, you know, around halfway through the race, and this is one of those events where you kind of got to forget about what the goal time is or what the expectations are, and race the field. But yeah, talking about adversity, like I'll lead in with going into the race. I guess backing up a few months, you know, ago, I knew I didn't have the capacity to swim and bike a lot, so I really wanted to shift my goals and target a marathon again. And the first couple of weeks of training, I flared my knee flared up, and so I had to back off running right away. And once that cleared up, I was able to, you know, manage about 70 miles a week on average for about the 7 weeks leading into the race week. And unfortunately, I started to get like a bout of like Achilles tendonitis as well. So 3 weeks out, I was up in Michigan visiting my family, my parents, went out for an 18 mile long run, or no, 20 mile long run, and I, you know, started to get a little tender then. But it is manageable. So like I could just roll it out. I would take care of it. You know, I was able to continue on week after week. The following week I was down in Florida, went out for an 18 mile long run, but I had to stop like 5 or 6 times just to stretch out my calf and Achilles just to get through the run. And at that point I knew I was going to be concerned on race day, you know, of how the Achilles would hold up. So going into the race day, I gave myself a rule. I was like, if the Achilles hurts, I'm going to stop and call it a day, you know, because I didn't want to do any further damage. Had some dry needling done 2 days before, and I think that helped release some tension in the calf and Achilles. While I could still feel it race morning, I still set that rule for myself. So if it hurt too much, I was going to stop. But yeah, I guess race morning, went out for a warm up with a couple other athletes, you know, Becca and Haley, who are working triathletes as well. Becca's one of her coaches. They were running the half marathon. And when we towed the line, you know, all the pain went away. You know, that adrenaline starts pumping, the national anthem's going. They had a flyover with a helicopter, it's pretty cool. And then the gun went off. They started us with the half marathon field as well. So it was actually a little difficult to tell who was who, because the bibs on the front would notify you if you were, you know, in the half marathon field or the marathon field based on the color. But without being able to see everyone, I didn't really know until about mile two, when there was a lead bike and a lead golf cart that was taking us through the course. So first few miles I was leading, dropped a 5:20 the first mile, which was a little fast. My goal was to target, you know, 5:25 pace. And, you know, I started running through some familiar territory. You know, when I lived in Toledo back in 2012, started to see things I used to recognize when I lived there. And that was kind of exciting. But, as the miles kind of progressed, mile 4, 5, and 6, I could tell I felt a little uncomfortable, probably a little more uncomfortable than I wanted to for the race. And that's when I was caught by, you know, another competitor, and he took the lead at that point. You know, for the next 3, 4, 5 miles, I just stayed steady. But again, I knew the effort was a little too hot. Started back off to like 5:30, 5:35 pace. And as I started to approach the half marathon mark, I was contemplating if I was going to be able to get to the finish line. And I made it to mile 13.1. And
so why? What were you feeling? You were just so hurting, or
no,
what?
No. So that's the thing. Like I was almost wishing my Achilles hurt, because I wanted to stop, but I felt
everything else hurt.
Well, I would say nothing really hurt. There was really no discomfort. I was just fading, as if like I was running through molasses. So that's the way I'll describe it. Like my pace started to just fall apart.
Yeah, like a little bit of central fatigue there.
Yeah. And I saw mile 14 approaching, and I was like, this is it. You know, I'm going to call it a day at mile 14, you know, and I stopped briefly to walk at mile 14. And I was thinking to myself, well, I'm almost at the furthest point on the course. I might as well just run back at this point. I was passed by a couple of competitors, and, you know, so I started slowly picking it back up. I started running again. And at that point, like I said, like my Achilles wasn't hurting. So I was like, I can't just stop now because it doesn't hurt. Like, I can jog back. If I finish in 3 hours, it is what it is. So the next mile, got the mile 15, which is our, the elites had a bottle drop. We had 3 bottle drops. One was around mile 10, next one at mile 15, the last one at mile 19. So I got my bottle there. I had a half mix of Martin 360 in there, stopped, grabbed it, drank it. And then I started running again. And at that point, I think I was in 5th or 6th place. And in my head, I was like, well, if I get top 5, I still take home $300. So I'll aim for that. So the goal started to evolve at that point. And I got myself back into 5th place. And then mile 16 came, and I saw the leader that passed me at mile 6. He was walking. So at that point, I knew something was going on that day. You know, it wasn't an overly hot day. I know we looked at the temperature. It was warm, but not super warm. We had some light rain that morning. I think there's a lot of humidity in there. It was definitely damp. But he was walking, and I'm like, okay, something's up. I'm going to continue on. And
it sounds like you guys were just integrating, you know, Galloway's walk run program.
Pretty much, yeah. It was like this weird thing going on. And then at that point, I was like, okay, well, let's shoot for top three. You know, then I got myself into third place, and I could see the gentleman in second who has won the race in the past. And last year he went 2:22, and I started to reel him back in. Caught him around mile 21. And at this point, so I gotta tell everyone this too. Around mile 21 is where we ran through one of the metro parks in Toledo, and there's a mansion there, and that's actually where I proposed to my wife. And so as we're running through there, I saw the mansion, saw where I proposed to her. You know, overtook second place at that time, so it was kind of a cool moment. And we made another left-hand turn.
That's adorable.
I know. Made another left-hand turn onto a rail trail, and I could see the leader. And at that point, I was like, he's a lot closer than I expected to see him. And that's when I decided, like, I was ready to fight again. You know, I tell everyone during every race, like, you got to find that mental edge. And I lost it for a while during mile 14 and 15. And once I made that left-hand turn into the rail trail and I could see the leader, I was ready to battle. And he started slowly coming back. And as we chipped away the next couple of miles, I still wasn't sure if I'd catch him, but I was really paying attention to how I felt. I could feel my left calf, you know, grabbing a little bit. So I didn't want to cramp if I pushed the effort too much. And I was really paying attention to how he looked, you know, his stride, if he looked back. And I saw him looking back a couple of times. And at that point, I knew he was struggling as well. So I started to slowly reel him in. And with about 2 miles to go, I made the pass, and I dug deep and just counted in my head like to 20. You know, I wanted to put like a big surge in to mentally break him. And then after that, after I passed him, I just counted to 10. And every 10 seconds, I just made sure I was keeping pressure on the pace to build that gap, because I wasn't sure how much he had left, but I wanted to make sure I gapped him enough to where if it came down to it, you know, I could put in a little bit of a kick to the finish line. And
wait, so that 10-second thing, would you literally sort of count to 10 and then press?
Yeah. So, I mean, I would count to 10 in my head and just repeat it over and over again, you know, just 10 seconds here, 10 seconds here. Like every 10 seconds, lights or whatever, every 10 counts, just maintain that pressure on the pace. And so I didn't really worry about pace too much. I just making sure I was holding myself accountable during sure. those 10 seconds, and it just would repeat over and over again. We made our way back to the campus of the University of Toledo, and you know, we finished on the stadium or at you know, the 50-yard line, and that was pretty cool. So we ran to the stadium, and at that point, I knew I had the victory, and it was a pretty special moment. Like I said, like facing some adversity early on in the build of the training, and then also during the race. And you know, I really want to convey, like, you know, a lot of times these longer races, things are going to pop up and happen, and you never really know how anyone else is feeling, because everyone's putting on a facade, you know, everyone's preparing for battle. So you can't show your weakness, you can't show your cards, so you always got to show up. And you don't really know how things are going to play out until you get to the finish line. And this also goes true for workouts. You know, I've had athletes reach out to me in the past about how they felt the day before a workout, and they were unsure if they'd be able to complete it. And I always tell athletes, like, don't discount it until you're actually into the workout. Get the warm-up done and start it, see what happens. Same thing with a race. Like, there's going to be ebbs and flows. And I will say, this is the first time I've ever experienced like a second wind. And I don't know if I ever believed in that type of thing, but it is a case where something was going on around mile 14. You know, I felt uncomfortable beyond where I thought it was sustainable for the race. And, you know, things kind of clicked back, and I was able to press forward.
Here's the thing, you know, everybody makes up excuses for why they, you know, didn't do well, or they make excuses about how the build didn't go perfectly. And the thing is, there has not been a perfect build into a race executed by any endurance athlete ever.
That is true. Yeah.
There are always numerous things that pop up. There are missed workouts, illnesses, Achilles, you know, the issues that you have. And it is really the mark of a professional or the mark of, you know, an experienced athlete to just manage that and then still show up like you're talking about and lay down their best effort. Preparation is obviously essential, and you need to address issues, which you did, you know, going to PT, really paying attention to your Achilles and making sure that you're doing all the things right with nutrition and stuff. And we can talk about that. But always remember that when you toe the line, don't think about all of the obstacles or things that are going to sort of drag on your performance, because, you know, the truth is everybody's facing them and you can overcome them. Just focus on the good workouts and the sacrifices you made to toe the line and all of that. Focus on the positives from training. Obviously you have to do the work beforehand, but to have the privilege of doing that, but you know, you kind of did have the privilege to do that because you put in the miles. You know, 70 miles a week is pretty solid volume, especially with swimming and cycling. But yeah, I mean, you definitely overcame more diversity than normal, probably, especially, you know, when we think about you dry needling the week of or day before the race, which was, I don't know how risky that is. I've never, you know, experienced dry needling, but so that second wind that happened, you know, it kind of occurred when you took in carbohydrates, when you took in the Morton.
Yeah. So I guess I'll back up a little bit with the nutrition strategy. So I had 3 gels on me. I had 1 caffeinated Martin and then 2 regulars. I took in the caffeinated. So I took 1 caffeinated 15 minutes before the start, 1 at mile 4. And then I would cover myself with water at the aid stations. I grabbed a little bit of Gatorade Endurance leading up to that aid station as well. And I had my second gel, I think around mile 11, if I recall correctly. And then, yeah, when I got my first bottle stop, I took in more carbohydrates, which also had caffeine in it. And so the next mile after that second time I walked, I dropped a 5:26 and a 5:25 mile. So mile 17 and 18, I really, you know, got back into the groove of things.
Yeah.
And part of that was, you know, I was trying to chase down the guys that overtook me. But also I think it is a case like that caffeine kind of kicked in a little bit, just tasting the glucose, you know, that was helpful as well. But also just the mindset shift as well. Like mm-hmm. I knew I had to change my mindset and to get to the finish line. And cause at mile 15, I was like, I'm just going to jog it into the finish. But then, you know, once I saw another competitor walking, I knew there was probably things out of her control that was impacting the race, and it was time for battle again.
Yeah, you smelled a little bit of blood, I suppose, and then you were back in the race. Mentally, you were back in it. So it's good to, I think, talk about some strategies that athletes can employ when they're going through a rough patch of a race. And first off, especially in long course races or marathons, or I mean, any endurance event, really, if just because you're feeling really poorly at a given moment, it doesn't mean that it's a linear decay for the rest of the race of you feeling worse and worse and worse every minute that goes by. Many times you can reset, which you just did in this past weekend during the race. And I think, you know, 3 big strategies. One is just relax and shake everything out. I know it's tough to say relax when you're in the middle of a race and run, but there are things you can do. I mean, if you're going through a rough patch, it's okay to give yourself permission to slow down for a short period. You know, breathe deeply, focus on the exhale. And shake everything out, relieve the tension. And, you know, mentally that can offer kind of a good reprieve from the demands of the race to enable you to mentally attack the rest of the race, and get in calories and fluid and caffeine. Nine times out of 10, honestly, if an athlete is going through a rough patch in the middle of a race and they've been adhering to, you know, good pacing targets, oftentimes it's just they need some calories, or they would benefit from some calories. And doing that can be a game changer, as can caffeine. Caffeine can boost well-being and obviously bump up neural drive and potentially reduce perceived exertion at a given pace. So you will benefit probably from taking in caffeine, you know, assuming that you're a responder and you're not going to experience distress and stuff like that from it. But those three things, just shaking out, taking in calories, taking in caffeine, can go a long way. Plus, I mean, fluid, you can pair fluid with calories, but that can be a game changer. And then positive mental attitude. That's number one. When you take in that, view it as, you know, a little checkpoint and a little elixir that you could take in that will make you feel better. Believe it'll make you feel better. And literally the likelihood is that you will feel better afterwards. So, you know, there's potentially a little bit of a placebo in there, but even separately from the placebo, I mean, physiologically taking in calories, fluid, caffeine, and kind of just resetting your mind via shaking out and focusing on, you know, good deep diaphragmatic breaths, it'll help. You know, for you, I think you kind of did that. Plus there was the additional factor of you seeing other athletes going through the same thing.
Yeah.
And that's something else to remember.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's out there hurting.
Yeah. Yeah. And no matter, like, if you're, you know, competing to win a race or just trying to get to the finish line, like if you're competing against yourself, you still want to pay attention to everyone else and how they're looking, because that can give you some clues of what else is going on. Because, you know, we know weather impacts events, especially in long course, and you never really know until the end of the race when you can kind of look at all the data together of how it went, you know, cause like time matters obviously, but like sometimes you got to just race the race. And, you know, while sometimes it might not be a PR day, it's still, you know, a great effort for the day given.
Yeah, definitely. So since is it the last day? It is the last day of fueling and hydration month for Working Triathlete. Let's talk about your nutrition going into the race, the night before, the morning of, and then a little bit about intra race. So night before, did you carbo load? Day before, 2 days before, did you carbo load? And kind of what did you eat for dinner the night before?
Yeah. So definitely started loading up on carbs the 2 days before the race. Some pasta at lunch 2 days before, same thing with dinner that night, or the two evenings before. And then, yeah, the day before, I actually went to Chipotle and just loaded up on rice and chicken, a little bit of, you know, lettuce and a couple other things there. But I generally get pasta with a little bit of chicken. I was a little lazy and didn't want to drive too far from the hotel I was staying at. And I saw there was a Chipotle nearby, and that was convenient. You know, like I said, you know, obviously we know rice has carbohydrates in it, but,
yeah,
you know, really just wanted to top off the stores that evening. Also, I knew the race had the potential to be warmer, so loading up on electrolytes, sodium. You know, I had a couple additional Gatorades the days leading into the race, and then the evening before drank like another electrolyte drink as well the morning of, just to ensure the sodium stores were topped off as well. Leading into the race, like I said earlier, before, I had a gel about 15 minutes prior to the start. And, you know, I knew I had enough calories on me to get through the first half of the race. And then, you know, I knew there's gels on the second half of the course. So I had two Martin gels, you know, like I said, mile four, mile 11. And then the second half, I had three Honey Stinger gels, which was what was on course. I couldn't tell you what mile markers those were at, but every time I saw one, I just grabbed one. And I knew I needed as many calories as possible if I wanted to get to the finish line as fast as possible. So I grabbed the Honey Stingers and I'd grab the Gatorade Endurance that was on course as well. I couldn't tell you how much Gatorade Endurance I had. I missed my mouth quite a bit when I was trying to drink it, but definitely probably had about 8 ounces total the second half of the run course as well with that.
Got it. Yeah. So it highlights the importance of consuming calories during the race, and that's essential during a marathon. I often recommend that athletes take a gel every 20 to 25 minutes, assuming they can stomach it and they have access to fluid. When it comes to carrying those gels, there are various approaches. You can carry them in shorts. I am a big fan of the fuel belt, just the original traditional fuel belt. You know, I've never liked carrying things when I've been running, and you know, I mean, you ran in high school and college too, and you know that we never carried anything. We would go do 2 hour runs with nothing, and you know, if anybody, you know, carried a bottle, it would be just like almost a sign of weakness or something, which was really stupid.
I know.
It was really dumb that we did that, but that's just the way it was back then. And we know that fueling well during races enhances performance. Fueling well during long sessions, anything, say 90 minutes and above, you will recover better. Mm-hmm. Yeah, protein synthesis will occur. It enhances protein synthesis afterwards, you know, assuming that you're, you know, taking in, you know, good nutrients when you are running, and that is just good. It's going to make you better. So this isn't a nice to have, you know, it's a good, you should be taking in fluid and carbohydrates intra race for sure. But I've definitely found that athletes, if they're taking in Morton gels or pH gels, they can pretty consistently take in, you know, about 90 grams of carbs an hour, even in the marathon. Maybe that's a high target for certain athletes, and maybe it's not necessary to take in that many, especially if you fuel well before. If you carbohydrate load, and what that entails, a good target, you know, science shows 8 to 12 grams of carbohydrates per kilogram of body weight for the 2 days leading into a race, you can elevate your glycogen stores substantially. And towing the line with an additional, you know, 200 grams of carbs stored as glycogen, which can happen, it can enable you to, you know, run faster, and you're also storing more fluid that way. You know, it's the concept of towing the line, Puffy, which I say ad nauseum, but athletes need to do that. It's as important as the training.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you know, it helps for sure.
Yeah. Oh, I should mention too, I forgot to mention this. I also had another bottle at mile 19 and a half. So I had a mix of Martin 360 that I split between the two bottles at mile 15 and mile 19 and a half. So that second bottle, I made sure I got down as much as I could. And, you know, that one had some caffeine in it as well. And that definitely contributed to that last 10K of the run.
Mm-hmm. And so how much caffeine did you have in the morning and during the race?
I had a cup and a half of terrible hotel coffee.
Delicious.
And then, I mean, I don't know how much caffeine was in that cup and a half, but it was not good. And then I had the caffeinated gel 15 minutes prior, another caffeinated gel mile 4, and then between the bottle of the Martin 360 at mile 15 and mile 19 and a half. So I guess about 400 milligrams throughout the race or in leading into it.
Sounds good. That it's a good target. It enhances performance, so it's a good thing to consume. Cool. And then, so what's next? What's the next marathon?
Well, this morning I actually, you know, signed up for the Elite Wave at Detroit Free Press Marathon. That one I've eyed for a couple of years, and I was really hesitant on signing up for a marathon until after this one was done, because I was debating whether or not I would do a late season 70.3 or a marathon. And, you know, that one is kind of hits home. I didn't grow up in Detroit, but grew up close enough. And I know I'll see people I know there. But that one also has a cash prize as well. And that's also enticing because now I know I can make money running marathons. That's kind of neat. But yeah, so this season is going to be interesting. I'll target multi-sport nationals with the team, do a race or two there. You know, I'm currently signed up for Ohio 70.3, but I'm not sure if that one's going to be a race where I'm able to participate, or if I'm going to be too eager watching a lot of our athletes crush it. So I'd like to get 170.3 in this year, and if I do, it's going to have to be in July. But yeah, so Detroit is going to be the big one I target in October.
Cool. Well, I cannot wait to follow that. It's going to be fun. Awesome. Well, certainly, I think if people have any more questions on your race, they should send them over. And if you're looking for some additional help on reaching your racing goals, certainly reach out to us, whether you are a triathlete or a runner. We have very, very good coaches who can help you out. So feel free to submit a form on the website, www.workingtriathlete.com, or shoot us an email, info@workingtriathlete.com.
Thanks for tuning in, everyone.
All right. Thanks. See ya.
See ya.